I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. New waste bins in Washington, D.C. are helping to fight climate change. This year, D.C. installed about 30 smart bins on sidewalks across the city, where people can drop off food waste like table scraps. When food waste breaks down in a landfill, it produces methane, a powerful planet-warming gas. But the waste in these bins goes to a facility to become compost instead. The smart bins are rat-proof and can be opened with a keypad code or an app that also tells people which items are compostable. Just 8 weeks after installation, the new bins had collected 65,000 pounds of food waste.
From zero to 65,000 pounds, that's incredible.
John Johnson of the D.C. Department of Public Works says the smart bins are part of a citywide effort to keep waste out of landfills. Residents can also dispose of food waste at drop-off events, and some homes and small apartment buildings have food waste picked up curbside. But the new bins give anyone a way to compost 24/7.
This gives residents more of an opportunity, particularly those that live in multifamily buildings.
He says the smart bins have been so successful that the city is looking at expanding the program to keep even more food waste out of landfills. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia, this is CJSF 90.1 FM.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, your weekly report on Earth systems, human development, justice, and science. Today, Donald Trump's war on diversity, equity, and inclusiveness. We speak about Trump's first 180 days in the White House with American scholar and writer Dorothy Roberts. This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. It's been 7 months since the start of Donald Trump's second administration. 180 days feels like years. With lightning speed, razor-sharp precision, and the ferocity of junkyard dogs, Trump and his minions have slashed thousands of federal jobs, gutted departments responsible for health and education, environmental protection, medical research, earth and ocean science, climate science, international development assistance. War has been declared on the media, corporate and public. Center stage, Trump's signature campaign, driving millions of undocumented migrants out of the country, pursuing them with military savagery, locking them up in a network of gulag jails stretching from Florida, Louisiana, and Texas down to El Salvador. People who've lived and worked in America for years, who've never committed a crime, who've paid taxes, raised kids, kids born in America. Trump wants to strip them of their citizenship. Aside from migrant black, brown, and Hispanic folks, men and women who just want to earn a living in a country they think is great, nothing fills Donald Trump's throat with more bile than those three normative nouns: diversity, equity, and inclusiveness. Trump and his white America First lieutenants are now rooting out DEI programs with the zealousness of medieval crusaders. With me to talk about Trump's first 180 days, examining them through the lens of race, class, and gender, is Dorothy Roberts. Roberts is the 14th Penn Integrates Knowledge Professor, the George A. Weiss University Professor of Law and Sociology, and the Raymond Pace and Sadie Tanner Mossel Alexander Professor of Civil Rights at the University of Pennsylvania. She's also the founding director of the Penn Program on Race, Science, and Society, and a prolific writer. We reached Dorothy Roberts in Philadelphia. Hello, Dorothy Roberts. Thank you so much for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor again.
Sure. Thanks for having me again. I enjoyed our last conversation and I'm happy to be back.
And you're in Pennsylvania.
Yes, I'm in Philadelphia now.
Oh, how's Philadelphia doing? How's the weather?
Hot. Very, very hot. You'd think that we were in Miami. In fact, I was in Miami a few weeks ago, and it was hotter in Philadelphia that day than it was in Miami, Florida.
Dorothy, what's your take on DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusiveness, right? I mean, the concept, the target. What is it that Trump and his minions hate so much about DEI? Why the contempt? Can you explain this?
Well, DEI means different things to different people. I think the effort to include diversity, equity, and inclusion in various programs in universities, in corporations, in foundations, in policies, was an effort to acknowledge systemic and structural inequities and understand that there has to be some positive, affirmative way of bringing in people who have been left out in U.S. history and dominant policies and practices. So the idea of DEI was, you know, was in a way to soften anti-racist efforts or efforts at ending various hierarchies like class and gender ability. It actually is not as radical as it could have been.
I mean, when I think about it, I think, like, what's the alternative? Uniformity, inequity, and exclusiveness. Like, aren't those, is that what Trump and his people think America should stand for?
Yes. So I think it's important to first recognize that this is actually the original DEI efforts were a pretty mild efforts to address structural inequity. They were not super radical. We're not talking about income distribution. You know, we're not even talking about affirmative action. And so I think it's important to recognize initially that DEI was simply about including people, recognizing that diversity is good for universities. It's good for corporations. You know,
it's good for the biosphere.
It's good for the biosphere, exactly, whether we're talking about human beings or other living creatures. Okay, so, but for the current administration, the reason I think that it is so has become a target for defunding and not just defunding, attacking it as something that's harmful and something that's antithetical to what America stands for, is because it's a way of labeling inclusion and labeling efforts to make America more equitable as if they are harmful to America, as if they create division. I mean, this is part of the contradictory, infuriating ideology of the current administration, which is to take things that actually improve everyone's welfare and paint them as if they're anti-American or anti-patriotic. So now DEI becomes, according to this right-wing logic, something that is unfair, that is unjust, that is divisive.
I mean, but they deny racism. Those people deny the historical role of racism. These are the same people who attacked the New York Times for publishing the 1619 Project, yeah, which folks should read, who deny that there's any structural racism. In fact, people who say slavery was kind of good for those black people.
Yes. Again, this reversal of the truth, this reversal of history. So that it's important to see the connection to a couple of things I want to highlight. One is what you just said, that the attack on DEI is connected to the attempt to erase the history of America, to erase the history of slavery, the history of settler colonialism, the history of all sorts of unjust hierarchies in America. And DEI, you know, according to this attempt to erase these truths about U.S. history, represents the inclusion. You know, it's seen as a correction to inequality, which the right wing doesn't want to recognize. That's why they don't like DEI. It's a recognition. You know, why do we need inclusion if people were never excluded? You know what I'm saying?
I mean, literally getting back to this kind of quip of mine, that I think for a lot of these people, it really is true. They want there to be, they see America as being a white Christian state dominated by men, where there's fundamental entrenched inequalities and exclusive power held exclusively. And this they think is the foundations of America's America.
Yes. Which actually, that is part of the foundation of America. You know, America was founded on the institution of slavery, but what they, and the decimation of Native tribes and colonialism and all of that, that's foundational to U.S. history, but they don't think there's anything wrong with that. As you're saying, they think America should be, all the power and money in America should be controlled by a small group of elite white men. And so DEI, they see as an attack on that, and that's why they're attacking DEI. Now, I want to mention one other aspect of it, which I think is extremely disturbing. And this goes to something I wrote a lot about. I wrote a book called Fatal Invention, How Science, Politics, and Big Business Recreate Race in the 21st Century, about the resurgence of the biological concept of race, the idea that human beings are naturally divided into races. And along with that harmful, what I call a fatal invention, is placing supposedly biological racial groups into a hierarchy, with white people supposedly the most civilized, the most democratic, the most intelligent, the most beautiful, you know, and then you have a hierarchy going down to Black people who are supposedly, you know, stereotypically the least intelligent, the least capable, the least deserving of autonomy and of rights. This is connected to the attack on DEI. If you listen to the president's words when he attacks DEI, he often says the problem with DEI is it's putting into important positions people who are innately incapable of having them. Now he's not talking about the cabinet he's put into place, which is full of people who were not qualified for those positions. He's talking about Black and brown people. He's talking about immigrants, especially if they're Black and brown. And he's saying that DEI has put Black and brown people into positions that they're innately incapable of handling, and that DEI is dangerous. And it's based on this eugenicist idea that human beings are naturally divided into races, and that policy should give advantages to people deemed to be genetically superior. If you listen to the words of the president, he's long said this, that he is smarter. He's a winner because of his German genes. I'm not making this up. And there are many people who are his supporters, even in important positions, who have also advocated this idea that there's something innately superior about Europeans. I mean, just listen to some of the rhetoric. It's almost verbatim eugenicist kind of rhetoric about polluting the bloodline of Americans who are seen to be, you know, the people entitled to be Americans are people of European descent. So this is also part, it's more subtle, perhaps. You know, if you're someone who studied the history of racism and white supremacy and eugenics in America and globally, you will recognize this rhetoric. You'll see these connections.
And I was, again, reading the 1619 Project, which I kind of came onto years after it was published, that the chapter on medical education in America today at the most prestigious medical schools, that still in the curricula, you've got materials that were gathered by people in the mid-19th century, racist ideas about how thick black skin is and how relatively easier it is for black people to put up with pain.
Yes, absolutely. This is actually being taught in medical schools. And it's still believed. There was a study in 2016 at University of Virginia that asked lay people, but also medical students and residents. Residents are treating patients about their views, and they found a substantial number of medical students and residents believed false ideas about biological racial differences, like black people have thicker skin than white people, black people have less sensitive nerve endings. And we can trace, and I do so in my book, Fatal Invention, trace back to the slavery era, these concepts that were designed to support enslaving black people. Doctors who promoted the view that black people were innately less intelligent, innately lazy, but also that their bodies functioned differently, so that forcing them to work was beneficial for them, and that they didn't feel the harms of slavery because of black people's supposed innate imperviousness to pain. So these ideas are coming back. You know, I wrote my book, Fatal Invention, was published in 2011 during the Obama administration. And my thesis there was that the resurgence of these concepts serve to explain how there could be continued health inequities and other racial inequities in a time when America was supposed to be past racism. But they're even more prominent today under the current administration, because the current administration has no problem with stating these. In the presidential order, the executive order, related to the Smithsonian Institution and how the Smithsonian Institution was supposed to now change its view of history that focused on anything that focused on racism or slavery. It was supposed to end those exhibits and now have followed this new view of U.S. history that there hasn't been any racism in America, that slavery even, you know, was beneficial to black people. And it explicitly says in this directive that the idea that race is not a biological concept, but a social construction is wrong. That it explicitly said, points to an exhibit in the Smithsonian and that expressed the social construction of race. And it says that's an example of a divisive exhibit.
That's woke. That's woke.
It's too woke. It's too woke.
So I have a question for you, Dorothy. What impact, what evidence is there that diversity, equity, and inclusiveness programs in American federal departments and institutions and university institutions, the infiltration of these programs into the U.S. economy and all these places has actually improved outcomes for racialized people, black and brown and Hispanic, improved health outcomes, improved educational outcomes. I mean, this is huge. People have written volumes of books about this. But I'm wondering what evidence is there that DEI, you know, did good things, was accomplishing what it was supposed to accomplish. Right. And the flip side of that is are we now seeing measurable impacts, measurable reversal of those gains?
Yeah. Well, that's such an interesting question. I'm two minds on this because, as I was saying earlier, I don't think DEI goes far enough to address the inequities. So but on the other hand, there is evidence that paying attention to inclusiveness and equity and diversity, there's in so many realms, improves outcomes. You know, there's one thing that comes to mind immediately is a study of jurors and how they make determinations when there's a more diverse jury. You know, that they make better decisions. They're more careful. They understand the evidence better when there's more diversity on the jury. There's evidence that when you have more diversity in the medical profession, that there's better attention to the needs of minoritized or marginalized patients.
And better health outcomes.
Better health outcomes. But here's what I only pause there because. So let me just say, in general, there's so much evidence that attention to inequality and actually addressing it, actually addressing the inequality. Now, there's one thing to pay attention to it. There's another to actually do something about ending the inequality. But there's long been studies, historical studies as well as more contemporary ones, that show that addressing inequality improves everybody's health. You know, there's studies of nations in Europe that are less inequitable that show that that's part of the reason why there are better health outcomes in nations like, you know, the Netherlands and France and Denmark, because they have more equitable society. So just that basic idea that a more equitable society is a healthier one, that's been long established. That's why we spend so much money in the United States, and we're way down the list when it comes to wealthy industrialized nations in terms of our health. So that's been well established in the medical field as well as, you know, lots of other fields as well. But I would also add, though, that because there haven't been enough efforts to actually end the inequities, to end poverty in America, to end structural racism in America, to end all the social inequities that help to explain health inequities, like toxins in impoverished Black neighborhoods, police presence in those neighborhoods, high rates of incarceration, high rates of foster care placement. You know, I could go on and on and on about all the social reasons why people who grow up in impoverished Black neighborhoods or in impoverished tribal reservations have poor health. And those conditions haven't been addressed sufficiently. That's why we still see gross health inequities in America. We still see that Black women are far more likely to die from pregnancy-related causes than white women in America. And we also see that the maternal mortality rate overall in the United States is going up. Why is that?
Black babies are more likely to die in their first year than white babies.
Absolutely. 2 to 3 times more likely. And that has been consistent since the time of slavery. So my point is that paying attention to diversity, equity, and inclusion is important. It's essential to ending these inequities. You have to believe they exist. You have to, you know, see the evidence of them. And that's important to figuring out how to end them. But you also have to take steps to end them. And we haven't done enough. So you know, when you ask me what's the evidence that DEI has helped, well, yes, it's better than not paying attention to, it's better than denying the exclusion, than denying the inequities.
But now, meanwhile, of course, since over the last 175 days, federal government departments have seen their DEI units and programs and funded funding programs and projects totally eliminated, like NIH projects, funding projects from the National Institute of Health, focusing on DEI-related topics that are being examined at the most prestigious American universities, cut off, and on and on and on. I mean, school books being withdrawn by the Department of Education.
Yeah, so, okay, so here's the other half of my point. I said of two minds. I don't mean that my ideas are contradicting each other. I just mean there's two sides to this coin. One is that DEI hasn't done enough in the past. The other side is that now, instead of shoring up these programs, you know, instead of saying we need more research on how social inequities produce these disparate health outcomes, but not only more research, we need to address them. The opposite is happening now, which is cutting off the research to begin with, denying that the inequities exist at all. And it's even worse than that. It's not just denying that the inequities exist. It's saying that if you recognize them, you're the one who's racially divisive. So, it's saying that if you do research into the horrific disparities in infant mortality and maternal mortality along racial lines, you're the one who's racially divisive, instead of seeing that these disparities are evidence of structural racial division in America.
I mean, I was just reading these statistics that Black Americans in COVID, Black Americans were 1.4 times more likely than whites to get COVID, 3 times more likely to be hospitalized, and almost 3 times more likely to die. So this was carried out by the CDC. So I would imagine that the research that went into establishing them has now been rooted out.
I believe so. I don't know for sure, you know, individual research projects, but I know for sure that many of them have, the funding has just been cut. I have colleagues who've received letters that say, we're sorry, but because the program officers have no choice now, and they've been working closely with these projects to look into, for example, racial health inequities, and the researchers get a letter that say, sorry, we're cutting off the funding for your research. Postdoctoral fellows who thought they were going to go into this research after they're getting their PhDs and get letters saying, sorry, your postdoctoral fellowship has been terminated, eliminated. And databases that have collected the data showing these disparities, allowing researchers to use these data to understand the disparities better and hopefully address them, databases taken down. Can you imagine that you're a researcher relying on a database that's documenting the state of health in America, and it's just erased?
You are listening to a conversation with Dorothy Roberts, founding director of the Penn Program on Race, Science, and Society at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. Let's jump back in. So what's the impact been so far on programs such as your own, Dorothy Roberts? You're the director of Penn's Program on Race, Science, and Society. You'd think that your program would be really a target, that you're now struggling to sustain your grants, although grants, I'm sure you're surviving on grants that have been issued some years ago.
Exactly. Fortunately, I have a little tiny program that runs on funding from Penn. Really, we're not supposed to talk about this. This is the advice we're getting from counsel.